It's October 27th in the year 312, and two armies are preparing to face off against each other for the fate of the Roman Empire, the Roman world, and they're about to meet on the banks of the Tiber River. And of course, on one side, you've got Constantine, and he's set to be pitted against his brother-in-law, Maxentius. And the two are about to square off. And the day before this, Constantine is moving his troops into position when he looks to the sun and he has an encounter, a vision. There, looking up at the sun, he sees the sign of the cross, and on it is written this: conquer in this sign. In this sign you shall conquer. Unsure of what it meant, Constantine later that night had a dream, and in it Christ appeared to him and told him that he could defeat Maxentius with the sign of the cross. And so the next morning, Constantine's feeling divinely guided, and so he has his soldiers paint an early Christian symbol of the cross onto their shields, and they go to battle with each other, and Maxentius is decisively defeated by Constantine. Constantine is now the sole heir to the Roman Empire. And of course, this moment would be pivotal in Constantine's life. It would be influential in him converting to Christianity. In fact, the entire Roman world converting to Christianity. Constantine, you could say, had a goat on cow moment. He had this divine encounter. He had bumped into God, and it had changed the course of history. It had changed the Roman world. And yet, was that a divine encounter? Had he actually bumped into God? Was that vision from Christ? You see, for the early Christians before Constantine, they believed that Jesus revealed God on the cross. And what Jesus revealed about God on the cross that day was this: that God would rather die than kill his enemies. And this is not just something we're called to admire or respect about God. It's something we're called to imitate and follow and walk the same path. And so for the earliest Christians, waging war was completely incompatible with the Jesus path. We are called, like Jesus, to forgive our enemies, to rather die than kill our enemies, to be the forgivers. And so what really happened to Constantine on that day? Was that really a God moment? I mean, in hindsight, to me, it seems obvious that what happened to Constantine was a conflation of empire and power and Christianity coming together. The cross had been co-opted and turned into a weapon. It had been turned into a sword. But this highlights to me an incredible danger. You see, throughout this series, I've been highlighting the need for personal experiences with God, that only thinking about God, that beyond facts and logic, there's something about experiencing and bumping into God. And I've done this because I've become convinced that over the scope of a lifetime, we cannot get by on simply thoughts about God. We're going to need to run into God from time to time. But again, there's a danger in highlighting personal experiences, because it seems to me that what happened to Constantine was this divine encounter. It simply baptized and sanctified what Constantine was already planning on doing. If our personal experiences, divine encounters, don't go unchecked, you could say, well, at its worst, it can turn into us turning the cross into a sword. It can turn into us co-opting faith for our own personal gain. But this is where I find the Apostle John incredibly helpful. In 1 John 4, he says this: "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God." I like that idea a lot, and I think what John is getting at is this: is we need to question and doubt our own experiences as well. We can't just automatically take every spirit, every encounter, every experience that we've had as if it's completely legitimate and authentic. We need to sort of test our experiences, doubt them, put them to the test, you could say. But how exactly do we do that? How do we determine what exactly is a Constantine divine encounter and what is something genuine and authentic? And you know, I think there's a ton of places we could probably go with this. I'd love to explore it further. But for this morning, what I simply want to do is ask of us four questions about those times when it's felt like we've bumped into God. Use these questions as a way to sort of gauge, help us gauge whether what's happening to us is authentic or maybe something else. In the words of John, four questions that will help us test the spirits, test our own experiences. First question: do our bump into God moments ever critique, unsettle or judge us. And I mean, here's the thing today. I don't think many of us love the idea of a God who's above us, critiquing us or judging us. We don't love the idea of a God who stands above us and in some ways might critique us. But there's this fascinating story in Scripture in Daniel 5. You see, there's this king of Persia, and his name is King Belshazzar, and he's hosting this elaborate, eloquent banquet. Lots of people there. And while this banquet is going on, all of a sudden a divine encounter happens. A hand appears out of nowhere and writes something on the wall of the palace. And at first, everyone's confused. They're like, oh my goodness, this thing happened, this divine encounter. But nobody can interpret or understand what the writing on the wall means. And finally, they pull in Daniel, this Hebrew exile slave. They pull him in and say, can you interpret this? And he does. And the message to Belshazzar is this. Written on the wall, it says, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. I love that line. It's a great line. Essentially, the point is this. God shows up and says, Belshazzar, I'm not exactly impressed with the way you're living your life. The question for me is this. Is our view of God, is it capable of allowing for encounters like that, where God might bump into us and actually find us wanting? That God might bump into us and actually have some critique for us in the way we're living our lives? Because you see, I think one of the vanities of our time is we don't love the idea of anyone standing above us and critiquing us. We're the captain of our own ships. How dare anyone sort of point out maybe flaws in the way we're living our life? But there's a warning here. If our encounters with God won't allow for critique or judgment, then perhaps we've blocked ourselves from actually encountering God. And if our encounters with God never allow for that, that we put ourselves in the precarious position of maybe being Constantine. The only time we can bump into God is when it's baptizing and sanctifying what we're already doing with our lives. I mean, consider another mystical encounter in the Scriptures, one that we haven't looked at yet. It's the story of Jonah. And of course, we all know the story. It's all a little bit Hollywood. But when you get under the point of the story, it's actually quite powerful because Jonah bumps into God and God tells him to go to these very people that Jonah hates and to preach to them a news of repentance and forgiveness. And the thing is this, let's not sugarcoat what's going on here. The Assyrians that Jonah is being called to, these are the same people who raped and pillaged their way through Israel and hauled the Hebrew people off into exile. And now God is saying to him, go to them. And Jonah knows God all too well. He's like, I know where this is going. You're just gonna end up forgiving them. And so Jonah's impulse, of course, is to what? Run away. He doesn't like what he's hearing from God. He wants fire and brimstone for them. But God says, no, go with a message of grace and forgiveness. And of course, Jonah's like, no, I don't want to hear that. Of course, we know how the story ends. Big storm, a whale, big fish, whatever. And of course, Jonah ends up going there, but he's still bitter and resentful. But the point of the story in my mind is this, is there are times when we bump into God, when we're gonna be critiqued, asked to do things that we don't want to do, and our impulse might be to push that message your way. Our impulse might be to run. But if we're not open to these kind of encounters, then I'm not sure that we're any different than Constantine. Second question, do you have to buy your encounters with God? So get this, this was a number of years ago. I was shopping for a new pair of jeans and I'm a 33-30, well, maybe 34-30. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But it's a very hard jean to find. It's very hard to find length 30 for a short-legged fellas. Anyway, I'm in Guess and I'm getting this new pair of jeans. They have my size there. And I go and I get the jeans and I'm going through the checkout line and I realize that on your way to the checkout, there's this whole display of accessories. And I'm shocked to find that in the accessory section, there's a Celtic cross and rosaries for sale. It was like I was standing there going and it was like Guess was like screaming at me, hey, next time you're out on the town, why not accessorize with a bit of a spiritual look? It'll add a mystique to you. You could pull off maybe the urban spiritual look. They were trying to sell me spirituality as an accessory. And man, doesn't that just feel like the way it is today? Spirituality as an accessory to our lifestyles. I mean, in a time when it feels as though more and more people are becoming less religious but more spiritual, I'm amazed by what feels to me like the consumerism and shallowness of the way we pick and choose our spirituality these days. I mean, consider the spiritual marketplace, if you will. There's a product for almost every spiritual lifestyle, products designed to sort of give us a sense of enchantment and magic in our lives, whether it's floating in the saltwater tanks, which I've done, or it could be getting into herbs, crystals that are packed with energy. It could be essential oils. It could be taking shrooms. It could be burning sage or aromatherapy candles. If you're into exercise as a spiritual thing, there's a new bike or new pair of shoes to fit your spiritual lifestyle. It's like spirituality has become like an accessory that we can take on and put off anytime we want. And listen, don't get me wrong, we are sensual, experiential creatures, and I think all of those things can in some way enhance our spiritual lives. In all of those things, we can encounter God. I know people who have done many different things and had profound encounters with God. So I'm not saying those places can't be places of encountering God. What I'm saying is that we should be beware of spirituality being co-opted into consumer choices. Because here's the reality, God cannot be bought or sold, and anytime we have to pay for a spiritual experience, our warning bells should be going off. I'm convinced that there's no sort of spiritual experience we can buy that's going to be able to carry the weight of meaning that we're so looking for in this world. And so be wary of spirituality as a consumer choice, because if spirituality is a consumer choice, something we can pick up and dabble in as an accessory, then I'm inclined to think that those choices will, of course, simply become narcissistic, self-interested expressions of ourselves. It's like a Constantine moment. If our divine encounters only ever sanctify what we already like and enjoy in this world, then maybe we should beware of them. Spiritual experiences can't be bought or sold. Third, do our bump into God moments only ever call us to the easy, beautiful, and indulgent? I mean, here's the thing. It's no secret that I love going to the Scandinav Spa. I think that place is fantastic. And I've had incredibly refreshing moments there, moments that have felt incredibly like spiritual encounters, bumping into God moments. It's no secret that I love traveling to the US Southwest. The landscapes there move me, and I've had many moments there that have felt, well, enchanted. But here's the thing. Not only do both of those experiences cost money, but both of those experiences are sort of a little too easy, a little too self-indulgent, a little too beautiful, you could say. And I think we need to be wary whenever our spiritual experiences only ever prompt us towards the easy, beautiful, and indulgent. I mean, consider the life of Saint Francis of Assisi, right? And Francis is, of course, a really popular sort of icon, particularly because anytime you see pictures or portraits of him, he's surrounded by nature. Francis was known, of course, to love being outdoors. He wrote poems about the sun and the moon and the stars, and he's even known to have preached to the trees and the animals. He sort of comes across as this like hippie Christian guy hundreds of years ago. But there's more to Francis's story than that. Yes, he loved nature, but he had a profound encounter with God. And in that encounter, he felt called to leave the wealth of his family that he inherited. And so he devoted himself to a life of poverty. But when he first moved into a life of poverty, he spent most of his time just fixing up churches and cathedrals. But Francis sensed that he had a bit of a problem. You see, he felt he wasn't completely fulfilling the call he had been given by God when he had a spiritual encounter, when he had bumped into God. Francis had a problem because, you see, Francis was nauseated by lepers. And lepers were, of course, incredibly common back in the Middle Ages. But for Francis, this was a real problem because seeing a leper actually invoked a physical response to him. It made him feel nauseous. He thought he was going to be sick, even just seeing lepers. But he felt the call of God to go and be with the lepers. And so one day he's walking down a path and he sees a leper coming towards him, and he runs up to the leper and he gives the leper a kiss. And as he moves on from giving the leper a kiss, he recounts how he felt like his fear of lepers had completely left him. He had overcome that fear. And as he's walking down the path, he turns around to see the leper, and the leper has vanished into thin air. And for Francis, it was like he had just encountered Christ in that leper. Christ had come to him in disguise as a leper, and being willing to embrace the leper, he had overcome his fear. And Francis, of course, would spend a lot of time in nature, but he also devoted the rest of his life to caring for and aiding lepers. And this, to me, is the interesting thing. If our spiritual encounters only ever call us out into nature and beautiful and easy and indulgent things, then maybe we're missing out, because like Francis, there's also the hard that we're called to. The things that disgust us, the things that might actually make us feel a bit nauseous. And if our encounters with God only ever allow for the easy, the beautiful, self-indulgent, then maybe we've closed ourselves off from really experiencing God, a God who calls us to both beautiful and ugly, both the easy and the hard, both the indulgent times, but also things that call us to sacrifice. I mean, notice how Francis's story perfectly sort of mimics and follows the pattern that happened to Peter. Peter, you of course will remember, has this vision of unclean animals and eventually leads him to Gentiles, people who he was disgusted by, people he didn't want to associate with, people he would rather keep his distance from. And in that moment, God was calling him into the hard, the difficult. And I think these stories are important for us. Yes, we can experience God in the Scandinav spa, out in nature. Yes, we can encounter God out hiking in beautiful landscapes, but those are easy. Those are self-indulgent. And maybe we need to develop bigger eyes and realize that if we want to really bump into God, maybe that's found in going to the hard, the difficult, the not so easy places, maybe even the places and people that disgust us. When we're prompted to go there, we can be sure it's the voice of God calling us along the way. Fourth, do our encounters with God actually prompt us to give our lives away? As I've just been saying, is there a prompt in those encounters that makes us want to sacrifice, give our lives over to something? Early one morning, the phone rang in Martin Luther King Jr.'s house, and hoping not to wake his family, Martin jumped up and quickly got to the phone as soon as he could. And the moment he picked it up, the first thing he heard was a racial slur, followed by these words: "We're tired of your mess here. If you're not out of town in 3 days, we're gonna blow up your house and blow out your brains." Whoever was on the other end of the line hung up, leaving Martin completely unsettled, completely shaken and scared. You see, Martin had received threats before, but never something like this. This seemed different to him. And so Martin's sitting there in his kitchen, wondering what to do. He's scared because this is not only just about him. He's got a new baby daughter, a wife at home. He isn't quite sure how to respond. You see, Martin Luther had come to Montgomery, Alabama, hoping to finish his doctoral dissertation. His hopes and plans for the future is that he could finish that up and maybe lead a life, a quiet, simple life in academia, maybe become a professor one day. But everything changed for Martin Luther King on December 1st, 1955, when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a bus. And all that followed was that the black leaders in the community came together to organize a boycott of the city buses. And of course, they knew that if this was going to be a prolonged boycott, they were going to need to coordinate. They were going to need to organize. And of course, they were going to need leadership as well. And sort of reluctantly, Martin Luther King accepted that role, but he didn't realize how much it would cost him, what it would take from him. He still just wanted to be the simple pastor, the professor teaching in the seminary. But as Martin Luther King accepted that role, suddenly his life became conscripted. And there on that early morning, after sitting through that phone call and being scared for his life, scared for his family's life, Martin Luther felt like he was coming undone. He began to pray to God this way: "Lord, I am here taking a stand for what I believe is right, but now I am afraid. The people are looking to me for leadership, and if I stand before them without strength and courage, they too will falter. I am at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I've come to the point where I can't face it alone." And there in the dark of that early morning, after receiving that phone call, that awful phone call, Martin Luther King felt helpless as he was praying, but then he heard a voice. God spoke to him and said to him this, "Martin Luther, stand up for truth, stand up for justice, stand up for righteousness. I will be at your side forever." And in that moment, Martin Luther King recounts how he felt his courage restored. He felt like he once again had the energy and motivation to continue on the path that he was called to. But more than just a moment of courage and inspiration in that moment, Martin Luther King would also call this moment his Golgotha moment. He knew that he was being called not only to fight for civil rights, he knew he was being called to take up his cross and follow Jesus, to give his life away for this movement and this cause. You know, the voice on the phone that night kept their promise to Martin Luther King. 3 days later, their house was bombed. And 12 years after that, Martin Luther King Jr. would fully arrive at his Golgotha moment as he was shot by an assassin. But Martin Luther King Jr. had fought the good fight. He had finished the race. He had followed the Golgotha call, fully giving his life over to the cause of civil rights. That moment in the kitchen where God spoke to him, it had carried him through to the very end. You know, late this summer, I was listening to a podcast on the greatest speeches ever given. And the one I was listening to was focused on Martin Luther King Jr.'s final sermon, final speech. And the story behind it is fascinating. And that night, Martin Luther King was scheduled to speak, but there was a massive storm that blew in, driving rain. And Martin Luther King Jr. had decided to skip the event. He wanted to sit in his hotel room and work on his sermon for Sunday. Throughout all the extra work that he did, he kept doing sermons on Sundays to his churches. And so he was sitting in his hotel room. It was going to allow others to speak at the event. He had decided to sit it out because of the bad weather, because of the driving rain, but he gets a phone call into his hotel room, and it's the organizers of the event, and they said, shockingly, despite the horrible weather, there's a massive crowd here, and Martin, they want to hear from you. And Martin Luther King Jr. is weary and worn at this point, but he decides he needs to go and speak. And as he arrives at the venue and takes the stage, if you watch and listen to the full speech, you can almost hear how fatigued he is. There's almost a sense of melancholy, a sense that he knows his time is near. And right at the end of the speech, you can see his sort of energy rising. There's a charisma there. It's like he knows he's speaking in a very prophetic way. Just this sense haunts the whole speech that it's building to this crescendo. And Martin Luther King Jr.'s final sermon ends this way.
"Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord."
Find that speech so moving. 12 years after his encounter with God, 12 years after his Golgotha moment, and now it's finally arrived. And there, in the end, facing death, he's still filled with a sense of joy. There's no fear in him. He's been to the mountaintop. He's seen over into the promised land. He's seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He'd finished the race, fully walked the path of giving his life away, fully in self-sacrificial service. And this is the final test, the final moment for us, the final question for us when we consider our divine encounters. When we experience those bump into God moments, are we in some way being called to give our life away as well? That's the final test, the truest test, because any encounter with God will in some way, big or small, call us to give our lives away in service to others. And if you parse the mystical experiences, the encounters with God we see in the Bible, we find the exact same thing over and over again. Moses has an encounter with God and he's called to give his life into service of Hebrew slaves, to call and bring them up out of Egypt. Jonah is called to give his life away, to go in service to the people that he hates most. Peter is, of course, has this encounter with God and he's called to go to the people he's disgusted by. Paul himself, he has this encounter with God and it calls him to give his life away in service to the very people he was persecuting. Same thing with Francis, he's called to give his life away to lepers. Martin Luther King Jr. called to give his life away in service to the cause of civil rights. If we're going to parse our encounters with God, we can be sure of this. In ways big or small, there will be some sort of call to give our lives away. You know, one of the things I've enjoyed most about this series is hearing from some people at Nexus telling me about their own goat on cow moments or their own bump into God moments. And one of the ones that I've heard most frequently is parents telling me about the sense of sacred, divine bump into God moment when they had their children. This overwhelming sense that as they held their child for the first time, this magical enchantment moment happening. And you see, it doesn't need to be just as big as Martin Luther King's voice or Johnny Cash's or Jonah's or Francis of Assisi. But even in a moment like that, what we understand is there as parents, when you hold your child for the first time, you're being asked to give your life away. In that moment, as you become a parent, what's happening is you are being conscripted into service. God is calling you to now set aside your own plans, your own interests, for the sake of another. And I think what we will find is when you look into your past and recall and reflect on those moments where it feels like we've bumped into God, there'll be some sort of moment like that for you as well. Some sort of moment where it felt like we were being called to give ourselves into service, to give our lives away. And so these are good test questions for us. Do our experiences ever allow for us to be critiqued or judged? Do our experiences with God, do they only come because we spent some money on some sort of accessory or experience? Do they only call us to easy or indulgent or beautiful things? And finally, do they call us in some way to give our lives away? Do they call us to be people of the cross, people of Jesus who give ourselves away for others, who extend love and forgiveness and compassion even to those who are most difficult to us? So my hope, friends, is that maybe these four questions will allow us to sift through and test our own experiences and encounters. My hope is that, of course, these questions will allow us to train our eyes, learn to see, and as we do so, recognize that maybe we're bumping into God more often than we thought.